we expand the Medicaid population and the federal government fails to keep its financial commitment, the state would likely have to backfill four lost federal dollars to cover beneficiaries of the expansion.
Governor Parnell says no to expanding Medicaid. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, residents of King Cove asked Secretary Salazar to approve a road through the Eisenbeck Refuge.
I feel that just optimistic, hopefully, that he'll take a closer look at this issue.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Eight Republican governors to date have decided to split with their party and accept federal funding for Medicaid expansion in their state. Today, Governor Sean Parnell announced that he won't be joining them, at least for now. At a press conference this morning, Parnell said he will not be asking legislators to put any money toward broadening the health program and opening it up to more low-income Alaskans. His concern is that the federal government could end up not providing the promised funds, given the current fiscal climate in Washington.
If we expand the Medicaid population and the federal government fails to keep its financial commitment, the state would likely have to backfill four lost federal dollars to cover beneficiaries of the expansion.
Parnell plans to revisit the prospect of Medicaid expansion in December when he rolls out his annual budget proposal. If Medicaid were expanded in the state, it's projected that it would extend coverage to 40,000 Alaskans. Under a provision of the Affordable Care Act, the federal government will cover the full cost of growing the program for the first 3 years. After that, the state's share would gradually rise to 10%. Because the federal government will start offering extra money for Medicaid expansion in January, putting off a decision on the program means that Alaska will be opting out of that funding for the first 6 months that it's available. Residents from King Cove met with Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar this morning in Washington, D.C. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, they say they're cautiously optimistic the outgoing secretary will allow a land transfer to permit a road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge.
The saga has been going on for decades, and Wednesday evening, the dozen or so residents in D.C. were expecting nothing more than a photo op with Secretary Salazar. Thursday morning, they were pleasantly surprised.
We're closer now than we ever have been.
That's Stanley Mack, immediately after his meeting with Secretary Salazar Thursday morning. He's the mayor of the Aleutians East Borough. By his count, he's been fighting for a connector road from King Cove to Cold Bay for 30 years. Mack called the meeting with Salazar excellent. He says he's confident Secretary Salazar will reevaluate a fish and wildlife decision that blocked the land transfer. But it's not certain he'll reverse the decision. Mack says Salazar is a hard negotiator and even harder to read. Della Trumbull says Secretary Salazar needed to hear the human factor, that the environmental review has not taken people's lives into consideration. She's more optimistic now, if for no other reason, the meeting went longer than planned.
We initially had a half-hour meeting, but he did allow us a little over an hour, and I feel that just optimistic, hopefully, that he'll take a closer look at this issue, as he does and has said that he understands it a lot better from us being here.
The state would cede 41,000 acres, and the King Cove Corporation would cede 16,000 more. In exchange, they'd receive a 200-acre easement in the wildlife refuge. That easement would allow for the construction of a 10-mile, one-lane gravel road. The residents say they need it for emergency medical services, that flying in and out of King Cove is too dangerous. That's Tricia Trumbull's point. She's another King Cove resident in D.C. She says weather in the Aleutians can change on a dime, making one flight safe and the next dangerous. She recounts the crash she survived in 2010.
The pilot stated that we were, you know, he was coming in, getting ready for landing, and it was about 60, and all of a sudden we hit an air pocket, and it dropped, and then made the whole plane drop, and then he looked at the speedometer, and we were going 120. He was lucky enough to bring it up and crash that plane, perfectly landed on the runway, which then it had turned sideways and we went down the runway sideways.
She remembers how close death was.
And then there was fuel shooting out, and if it didn't have a gravel runway, we would have, and it was pavement, any spark could have, I think, plane could have blown up.
The residents would be allowed to use the road for everyday use, but it could not be used for commercial purposes. There would be a cable barrier to prevent people from driving off-road on ATVs to hunt birds. Nicole Whittington Evans is the Alaska Regional Director for the Wilderness Society.
A one-lane gravel road with a speed of 10 to 15, maximum 20 miles per hour on it, from King Cove to Cold Bay will be approximately 35 to 40 miles. It's going to take an hour and a half to 2 hours for a person to drive that road in good weather.
She says the federal government paid for a hovercraft that could take residents from King Cove to Cold Bay in 20 minutes. The borough stopped operating the hovercraft in Cold Bay and moved it to Accutan. Mayor Stanley Mack says the hovercraft cost more than $1 million per year, and it was unsafe in high seas and strong winds.
The $1.2 million hovercraft was just the sporadic operation of the hovercraft. We could not operate it. It was costly and unreliable. Totally.
The Department of Interior will not decide the fate of the road before Salazar's 30-day review March 18th. He could resolve the issue before his successor, Sally Jewell, is confirmed. Senator Lisa Murkowski, who supports the road, met with Ms. Jewell Wednesday morning, a normal part of the confirmation process. Senator Murkowski says she did not ask for any assurances on the land transfer.
I want Secretary Salazar to do the right thing. Plain and simple. I don't think that he should let this hang over and let he needs to right this wrong that his agency has put forward. And I want him to correct that.
Even though she puts the onus on Secretary Salazar, Ms. Jewell may feel the punishment. If Secretary Salazar does not override the decision before stepping down, Senator Murkowski threatens to hold up the nomination of Ms. Jewell. Parliamentary rules allow any senator to stall any proceedings. Della Trumbull says that even though she's feeling optimistic after the meeting with Secretary Salazar, she's prepared to continue fighting.
We've always maintained, before you make a decision on this, please, please talk to us. And the other point is, we can send a plane load of this large group every week because there are so many stories about why this road is so important.
But they're unlikely to get another meeting with the Interior Secretary. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Governor Sean Parnell's oil tax proposal is steadily making its way through the Senate. His bill advanced out of the Senate Resources Committee on Wednesday with a few changes. Instead of setting the base tax rate at 25%, it bumps it to 35%. It offsets this by increasing a tax break for oil produced from new areas, giving oil companies a $5 per barrel credit. It gets rid of a mechanism that would raise taxes on oil companies when profits are high. Parnell described the changes as a positive step forward. The new version of the oil tax bill impact on the state's revenue is similar to Parnell's original version. According to the bill's fiscal note, it would cut taxes on oil companies by up to $900 million over the next year. Parnell's would cut taxes by roughly the same amount. The new version of the bill got the support of all of the members of the Resources Committee except for one. Senator Hollis French, an Anchorage Democrat, still had questions about the effect the bill would have both on oil production and revenue, and he had concerns about the pace of the review process.
The amendments we just adopted make some significant changes. The CS we put in front of us last Friday basically revamps the governor's bill and adopts some significant new measures. I don't feel like that we've fully vetted that. The fiscal notes, which we all received this afternoon, have not been discussed by the committee. And so I believe the totality of the circumstances are that this is rushing through this committee to the next one, and I don't feel confident of the work.
Senator Peter Michicki, a Republican from Soldotna, countered that a previous committee had already spent time with the bill, and there are still more hearings to come.
Some of us have spent hundreds of hours processing this bill in two different committees.
The bill is now being heard in Finance, the last Senate committee that will review the plan. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, heated testimony against a plan to limit municipal workers' unions in Anchorage.
I suggest that you sit down and negotiate in good faith with the working men and women of the municipality and negotiate a contract.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association.
Hundreds of union workers turned out to testify before the Anchorage Assembly last night against an ordinance that would limit unions. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Cars driving by honked their horns in support of protesters at the corner of Denali and 36th outside Lusac Library. That's where I found Kimberly, holding a red and black sign in support of unions, and her dad, a union member who works for the Anchorage School District.
I know he works very hard for what he does, and so I want to support him with that because he supported me for so long.
Kimberly's dad, Tom, says his job isn't at stake because he's not a municipal employee. But Tom says if the mayor's proposed ordinance does pass, he's afraid his job could be next.
I think the big fear is the reduction in their standard of living for your middle class people. We're just tired of seeing the erosion of the middle class. We want to make the middle class strong. That's why this country became real strong, is because of the middle class, not because we have rich and poor with nobody in between.
Tom and Kimberly didn't want to use their last name. Near the library entry, it was a sea of more red and black signs, and a saxophone serenaded protesters. Officials estimate there could have been around 1,000 people at the hearing, which took place in the Anchorage Assembly Chambers at the Lusac Library. The Wilder Marsden Theater was opened with live broadcasts from Assembly Chambers, and others crowded into the entry to sit and stand around a TV. Inside the Assembly Chambers, it was standing room only, and a line to testify stretched from the podium to the back of the room. Mayor Dan Sullivan proposed the ordinance, which would impact approximately 2,200 municipal employees, about 3 weeks ago. It eliminates raises based on longevity and performance, links pay to a 5-year average of the Consumer Price Index, and limits benefit choices. It also eliminates the option of a strike. But its centerpiece is the introduction of managed competition, a process in which a public agency competes with private firms to provide public services. Fire and police departments, as well as emergency services, would be exempt from managed competition. Public testimony was emotional, as one municipal employee after another got up in front of the assembly to tell them the ordinance was a bad idea. Municipal worker Roy Smith, who said he's lived in Anchorage for nearly 30 years and worked for the city for a decade, said the ordinance was evil.
Almost as evil as, what do I want to compare it with? How about the movies? How about Star Wars? Darth Vader and the dark side of the force. This is wrong. I know you mean well, and I tell you what, when I hear the radio spot that's being aired, I hear the warm fuzzy stuff up here in my head, but down here in my gut, this is what tells me the truth. And if I feel sick.
Smith was referring to a radio ad that began airing last week featuring Mayor Sullivan talking about his proposed ordinance. Assemblymember Dick Traney asked Smith this about the radio ad.
How do you feel about your tax dollars being utilized to bring that message out to the public? $28,000 in taxpayers' dollars.
Thank you very much. I don't feel good about it at all. Not at all. Not one bit.
Julius Matthew, a resident of Eagle River, says he's been a member of the IBEW for 30 years. He says he's offended by the mayor's so-called Responsible Labor Act.
There's nothing responsible about it whatsoever. This is not about money or trying to control the spending of money. This is about control. So Sullivan wants control over thousands of hardworking men and women that have banded together in the form of unions to protect their families against guys like Dan Sullivan.
Mayor Sullivan left the Assembly Chambers about halfway through the hearing. Ordinance 37 is scheduled for a vote of the Assembly on March 12th. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska has one of the fastest-growing senior citizen populations in the country, yet affordable housing for seniors is lacking. In December, a group of state and community leaders got together in Anchorage to discuss options for providing senior housing to meet growing demand. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the Alaska Senior Housing Summit has outlined the challenges ahead and the strategies needed to overcome them.
The so-called silver tsunami is lapping at Alaska's shores, and care providers are worried that there won't be sufficient programs or enough funding to meet it. The graying of Alaska is more pronounced than in other areas of the country. Alaska leads all states in having the fastest growing senior population of persons 65 or older, which now accounts for 13.6% of state residents. One of the top priorities for Alaska's seniors is housing. Denise Daniello with the Alaska Commission on Aging did not want to comment on tape, but she says senior housing needs to encompass the full range of care, from helping independent seniors stay in their own homes to creating living facilities for seniors with special needs. With limited funding, that is going to be a tough task. Mark Romick is Director of Planning and Program Development for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, which plays a multifaceted role in senior housing.
The demand for senior housing is like every other housing component of the market. It's based on people's ability to pay, and suffice it to say that there is a fairly substantial need, well over, 400 or 500 units in the next 10 to 20 years.
Most senior housing funds come from two pots of money AHFC manages from the Federal Housing and Urban Development Agency. Romick says in general, projects for low-income seniors are financed through grants, but assisted living or medium-income facilities have to rely on private financing or loans. AHFC offers rental assistance or vouchers to low-income renters of any age, but the waiting list is long, often years. And the sequester is expected to add to the crunch by shrinking that program, according to HUD spokesman Lee Jones.
The number of available vouchers is going to be reduced by about 125,000 nationally. That obviously shrinks the resource base for people who need that kind of assistance.
Since the majority of Alaska's senior housing projects target low-income seniors, middle-income seniors suffer. They have too much money to qualify for rental assistance or low-income housing, but they can't afford market-rate rents. AHFC data indicates about two-thirds of Alaska's seniors can't afford urban rents. A brief white paper released this month by the State Department of Health and Social Services identified some funding strategies that could be used to develop graduated income housing to accommodate residents of mixed incomes. Again, Mark Romick.
I think it's pretty obvious that alternative sources need to be developed. Private financing is a huge component of that. There is not enough money available through the state or federal government to address the housing need of all the seniors that might need an affordable place to live. People are going to need to be more creative about how they address the financing of senior housing in the future.
One group of seniors in Fairbanks is a jump ahead of the game. Karen Parr says the Raven Landing retirement community there was created, funded, and designed at the instigation of a group of retired teachers who wanted to stay in Fairbanks but couldn't find middle-income senior housing in their city. Parr says Raven Landing is a model for communities looking for solutions.
The thing that's so good about the Raven Landing that's kind of unique is that it was created by a group of local residents who planned it to suit this particular group of people, this kind of people. It's kind of an Alaskan version of a continuing care plan.
The city helped to buy the land it's on, and in 2008, the first building with 20 units opened. Another 20 units became available last year, and 20 more opened up last month. AHFC has provided grants and loans for each of the apartment buildings, while individual and corporate donations help support the Retirement Community of Fairbanks nonprofit, which operates the complex. RCF is now in the process of getting funds to build a community center. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
The Junior North American Sled Dog Championships are underway in North Pole. Among young mushers competing is a group of Midland High School students who flew in with their dogs from an interior village to race. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
A team takes off in the 6-mile, 4-dog race Tuesday. There's nothing unusual about kids running dogs in Alaska, but mushing is a new activity for a few at this year's North American Junior Championships. The kids are part of a school program in the village of Huslia, run by legendary sprint racer George Atla and three other village kennel operators. At nearly 80 years old, George Atla has experienced the peak of village dog mushing and its more recent decline. He says bringing mushing back is important because working with dogs makes you feel good.
A long time ago, when I first started racing and there were different guys that were racing and becoming champions, there was a lot of pride in the village of the dogs, you know, the dogs that they own. And we lost all that down through the years.
The Huslia program is helping about 30 middle and high school kids reconnect with their mushing heritage as part of their school day.
I'm Courtney Agnes. I'm from Huslia.
Jasmine Vent from Huslia.
So how'd your girls get into dog mushing?
Our Grandpa George and my Grandpa Wilson. I own 4 puppies and 3 older dogs.
And how much racing and training do you do?
At least 3 times a week with George. And kind of all day with my grandpa from out of school and then till I'm done feeding them.
The girls say their favorite part of mushing is just being with the dogs. The Junior North American Sled Dog Racing Championships continue through Thursday. In North Pole, I'm Dan Bross.
A proposed monument in Juneau to Japanese Americans interned during World War II got a big boost last weekend. The Gastineau Channel Historical Society donated $5,000 to the Empty Chair Project, and a fundraising concert raised nearly $2,000. As KTOO's Casey Kelly reports, organizers have been collecting funds for about a year and are getting close to meeting their goal.
Third-generation Japanese-American violinist Steve Tada and pianist Nancy Nash perform composer Michio Miyagi's Haru no Umi at the Empty Chair Benefit Concert on Saturday. Sisters Mary Tanaka Abo and Alice Tanaka Hikido sat in the front row as honored guests. Alice Tanaka was 9 years old in 1942 when the entire family was taken from Juneau and placed into internment camps.
We were identified with the enemy when we were not the enemy at all.
Brother John Tanaka, who died several years ago, inspired the Empty Chair Project. He was valedictorian of Juneau High School's class of 1942, but could not attend graduation after the family was taken from the capital city. The school set up an empty chair at the ceremony to acknowledge that John Tanaka was not there. The memorial will be a slightly larger than life-size bronze replica of the empty chair at Juneau's Capitol School Park, located next to the old Juneau High School. Project organizer Margie Shackelford has been friends with Mary Tanaka since childhood.
We can't always redress everything, but we can at least acknowledge that an injustice occurred.
The Tanaka's father, Shonosuke, operated the City Cafe in downtown Juneau for more than 50 years. In the early 1940s, the territorial capital was home to about 6,000 residents, and the restaurant was open 24 hours a day to serve miners, fishermen, and other laborers. Alice recalls that federal agents came for her father just a day after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941.
They took all the men, actually. It wasn't just my father, but all the immigrant-born men. Then shortly
after that, they were taken away from Juneau. We didn't know where they were going to be taken to. So there's a lot of unknown.
While their father was interned in Santa Fe, New Mexico, the Tanaka children and their mother were sent to Camp Minidoka in Idaho, where they would spend the next 3 years.
It was a small room that we shared with a potbelly stove, and that was our home for the duration of the war. And then we had all our meals in the mess hall, did all our showering and bathroom needs in what they called the laundry room. So it was kind of a communal kind of a living.
Violinist Tada, whose family lived in the Seattle area, had relatives taken to Camp Minidoka as well.
They published what was called a memory book, and it has group photos of everybody's family in front of their barracks. It kind of reads like a school yearbook. I mean, they had social clubs, tried to have dance bands and, you know, and morale builders, and they even had Boy Scout troops.
After the war, the Tanakas returned to Juneau, where Alice says her father reopened the city cafe with community support.
He had to take a loan out from the bank, and the bank gave him the loan unconditionally. And suppliers were family friends that told my father that he didn't have to pay his bills until he had a cash flow that made it possible.
Seattle artist Peter Raquem has a design concept for the Empty Chair Memorial. Shackelford says it will include the names of all the Japanese Americans taken from Juneau during World War II.
Plus a Japanese symbol for remembrance and memory, and a text telling the story of the empty chair.
With the funds raised at the benefit concert, organizers are confident they'll be able to dedicate the memorial in the summer of 2014. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.